strays from the tangled looming green of oak-walled forest to his right. Behind him, a thatched roof cottage, its gray stones crusted in green and orange lichen. An ancient well sat a few feet away, its bucket balanced precariously on the stone lip. Beyond it, attached to the house itself, a small pen with wandering chickens, fat and focused on the dirt before them. And past them, a garden. Not a formal, beautiful thing, but a garden behind a low stone wall, its wooden gate open. Two figures were stooped amongst the carefully plotted rows of green. He drifted toward them. He knew her by the golden brown hair, so much lighter in the summer sun. Her skin had turned a lovely deep brown, and her eyes. It was a child's face, lit with joy, that looked upon the woman kneeling in the dirt, pointing toward a pale green plant with slender purple cones of blossoms swaying in the warm breeze. The woman asked,
"And that one?"
"Salvia."
The child, no more than 9, answered.
"And what does it do?"
The girl beamed, chin rising as she recited.
"Good for improving memory, alertness, mood. Also assists with fertility, digestion, and... in a salve can help numb the skin."
"Excellent."
The girl's broad smile revealed 3 missing teeth. The woman, her mother, took the girl's round face in her hands. Her skin was darker than her daughter's, her hair a thicker, bouncier curl. But their builds. It was the woman's build that the girl would grow into one day. The freckles that she'd inherit. The nose and mouth.
"You have been studying, my wise child."
The woman kissed her daughter on her sweaty brow. He felt the kiss. The love in it, even as a ghost at the gate. For it was love that shaded the entirety of the world here, gilded it. Love and joy. Happiness. The sort he had not known with his own family, or anyone else.
The girl had been loved, deeply,
unconditionally. This was a happy memory, one of a few.
"And what is that bush, there by the wall?"
the woman asked the girl. Her brow scrunched in concentration.
"Gooseberries?"
"Yes. And what do we do with gooseberries?"
The girl braced her hands on her hips, her simple dress blowing in the dry, warm breeze.
"We..."
She tapped her foot with impatience, at her own mind for not recalling. The same irritation he'd seen outside that old man's house in Antica. Her mother crept up behind her, sweeping the girl into her arms and kissing her cheek.
"We make gooseberry pie."
The girl's squeal of delight echoed across the amber grasses and clear streams, even into the tangled ancient heart of Oakwald. Perhaps even to the White Fangs themselves. And the cold city nestled at their edge. He opened his eyes and found his entire foot pressing into the couch cushions. Felt the silk and embroidery scratching against the bare arch of his foot. His toes. Felt. He bolted upright, finding Irene not at his side. Nowhere near. He gaped at his feet. Below the ankle, he shifted and rotated his foot, felt the muscles. Words stalled in his throat. His heart thundered.
"Irene,"
he rasped, scanning for her. She wasn't in the suite, but... sunlight on brown gold caught his eye. In the garden. She was sitting out there. Alone. Quietly. He didn't care that he was half-dressed. Kaol heaved himself into the chair, marveling at the sensation of the smooth wood supports beneath his feet. He could have sworn even his legs, a phantom tingling. He wheeled himself into the small square garden, breathless and wide-eyed. She'd repaired another fraction, another... She'd settled herself in an ornate little chair before the circular reflection pool, her head propped up by her fist. At first, He thought she was sleeping in the sun. But he inched closer and caught the gleam of light on her face, on the wetness there. Not blood, but tears, streaming silently, unendingly, as she stared at that reflection pool, the pink lilies and emerald pads covering most of it. She stared as if not seeing it, not hearing him.
Irene.
Another tear rolled down her face, dripping onto her pale purple dress. Another.
Are you hurt?
Kaol said hoarsely, his chair crunching over the pale white gravel of the garden.
I'd forgotten,
she whispered, lips wobbling as she stared and stared at the pool and did not move her head.
What she looked like. Smelled like. I'd forgotten her voice.
His chest strained as her face crumpled. He hauled his chair beside her own, but did not touch her. Irene said quietly,
We make oaths to never take a life.
She broke that oath the day the soldiers came. She had hidden a dagger in her dress. She saw the soldier grab me and she leaped on him. She closed her eyes. She killed him to buy me time to run.
And I did. I left her.
I ran and I left her and I watched.
I watched from the forest as they built that fire. And I could hear her screaming and screaming.
Her body shook.
She was good,
Irene whispered.
She was good and she was kind. And she loved me.
She still did not wipe her tears.
And they took her away.
The man he had served. He had taken her away. Kaol asked softly,
Where did you go after that?
Her trembling lessened. She wiped at her nose.
My mother had a cousin in the north of Fenharrow. I ran there. It took me 2 weeks, but I made it.
At 11. Fenharrow had been in the middle of conquest, and she'd made it at 11.
They had a farm, and I worked there for 6 years.
Pretended to be normal. Kept my head down. Healed with herbs when it wouldn't raise suspicions. But it wasn't enough.
There was a hole in me. I was unfinished.
So you came here?
I left. I meant to come here. I walked through Fenharrow, through Oakwald, then over the mountains.
Her voice broke into a whisper.
It took me 6 months, but I made it to the port of Inish.
He'd never heard of Inish. Likely in Melisande if she'd crossed.
She'd crossed mountains. This delicate woman beside him.
She had crossed mountains to be here.
Alone. I ran out of money for the crossing. So I stayed.
I found work. He avoided the urge to look at the scar on her throat. To ask what manner of work.
Most girls were on the streets. Inish is not a good place. But I found an inn by the docks and the owner hired me. I worked as a barmaid and a servant and I stayed. I meant to only work for a month, but I stayed for a year. Let him take my money, my tips, increase my rent. Put me in a room under the stairs. I had no money for the crossing, and I thought I would have to pay for my education here. I didn't want to go without funds for tuition, so I stayed.
He studied her hands, now clutching each other tightly in her lap. Pictured them with a bucket and mop, with rags and dirty dishes. Pictured them raw and aching. Pictured the filthy inn and its inhabitants, what they must have seen and coveted when they beheld her.
How did you make it here?
Irene's mouth tightened, her tears fading. She loosed a breath.
It is a long story.
I have time to listen.
But she shook her head again and at last looked at him.
There was a
clarity to her face, those eyes. And it did not falter as she said,
I know who gave you that wound.
Kaol went wholly still. The man who had taken away the mother she so deeply loved. The man who had sent her fleeing across the world. He managed to nod.
The old king.
Irene breathed, studying the pool again.
He was possessed too.
The words were hardly more than a whisper, barely audible even to him.
Yes,
he managed to say.
For decades. I'm sorry I did not tell you. We've deemed that information sensitive.
For what it might mean about the suitability of your new king.
Yes, and open the door to questions that are best kept unasked.
Irene rubbed at her chest, her face haunted and bleak.
No wonder my magic recoils so.
I'm sorry,
he said again. It was all he could think to offer. Those eyes slid to him, any lingering fog clouding them clearing away.
It gives me further reason to fight it.
To wipe away that last stain of him, of it, forever. Just now it was waiting for me, laughing at me again. I managed to get to you, but then the darkness around you was too thick. It had made a shell.
I could see it, everything it showed you.
Your memories and his. She rubbed her face.
I knew then
what it was, who gave you the wound.
And I saw what it was doing to you, and all I could think to stop it, to blast it away.
She pursed her lips, as if they might start trembling again.
A bit of goodness,
he finished for her.
A memory of light and goodness.
He didn't have the words to convey his gratitude for it. For what it must have been like to offer up that memory of her mother against the demon that had destroyed her. Irene seemed to read his thoughts and said,
I am glad it was a memory of her that beat the darkness back a little further.
His throat tightened, and he swallowed hard.
I saw your memory,
Irene said quietly.
The man. Your father.
He is a bastard of the finest caliber.
It was not your fault. None of it.
He refrained from commenting otherwise.
You were lucky that you did not fracture your skull,
she said, scanning his brow. The scar just barely visible, covered by his hair.
I'm sure my father considers it otherwise.
Darkness flashed in her eyes. Irene only said,
You deserved better.
The words hit something sore and festering. Something he had locked up and not examined for a long, long time.
Thank you,
he managed to say. They sat in silence for long minutes.
What time is it?
He asked after a while.
3,
she said. Kaol started. But Irene's eyes went right to his legs. His feet. How they had moved with him. Her mouth opened silently.
Another bit of progress,
he said. She smiled, subdued, but it was real. Not like the one she'd plastered on her face hours and hours ago, when she'd walked into his bedroom and found him there with Nezrin, and he'd felt the world slipping out from under him at the expression on her face. And when she had refused to meet his stare, when she'd wrapped her arms around herself. He wished he'd been able to walk, so she could see him crawl toward her. He didn't know why. Why he felt like the lowest sort of low. Why he'd barely been able to look at Nezrin. Though he knew Nezrin was too observant not to be aware. It had been the unspoken agreement between them last night. Silence on the subject. And that reason alone. Irene poked at his bare foot.
Do you feel this?
Kaol curled his toes.
Yes.
She frowned. Am I pushing hard or soft? She ground her finger in.
Hard?
He grunted. Her finger lightened.
And now?
soft.
She repeated the test on the other foot, touched each of his toes.
I think,
she observed,
I've pushed it down to somewhere in the middle of your back. The mark is still the same, but it feels like...
She shook her head.
I can't explain it.
You don't need to.
It had been her joy,
the undiluted joy of that memory that had won him that bit of movement. What she'd opened up, given up, to push back the stain of that wound.
I'm starving,
Kael said, nudging her with an elbow.
Will you eat with me?
And to his surprise, she said yes.
Chapter 24.
Nezrin knew. She knew it hadn't been mere interest that had prompted Kael to ask her to talk to him last night. But guilt. She was fine with it, she told herself. She had been a replacement for not one, but two of the women in his life. A third one? She was fine with it, she repeated, as she returned from stalking through Antica's streets, not a whisper of Volg to be found, and entered the palace grounds. Nezrin braced herself as she peered up at the palace, not quite ready to return to their suite to wait out the brutal late afternoon heat. A massive figure atop a minaret caught her eye, and she smiled grimly. She was out of breath when she reached the Eyrie, but mercifully, Kadara was the only one present to witness it. The Rook clicked her beak at Nezrin in greeting, and went back to ripping at what appeared to be an entire slab of beef, ribs and all.
I heard you were headed here, Sartak said from the stairs behind her.
Nezrin whirled.
How?
The prince gave her a knowing smile and stepped into the Eyrie. Kadara puffed her feathers with excitement and dug back into her meal, as if eager to finish and be in the skies.
This palace is crawling with spies. Some of them mine. Is there anything you wanted?
He scanned her, seeing the face that yesterday her aunt and uncle had complained looked tired. Worn out. Unhappy. They'd crammed her with food, then insisted she take their four children back down to the docks to select fish for their evening meal, then shoved more food down her throat before she'd returned to the palace for the feast.
Still peaky, Zahida clucked. Your eyes are heavy.
Nezrin surveyed the view beyond, the city simmering in the late afternoon heat.
I just wanted some quiet.
Then I'll let you have it, Sartak said, and turned to the open archway into the stairwell.
No,
she blurted, reaching toward him. She halted her hand, dropping it immediately as it came within skimming distance of his leather jacket.
No one grabbed a prince. No one.
I didn't mean you had to leave. I don't mind your company.
She added quickly, Your Highness. Sartak's mouth quirked up.
It's a bit late to be throwing in my fancy title, isn't it?
She gave him a pleading look. But she'd meant what she said. Last night, talking with him at the party, even talking with him in the alley outside the Torre a few nights before that. She had not felt quiet or aloof or strange. She had not felt cold or distant. He'd done her an honor in giving her such attention, and in escorting her and Kael back to their rooms. She did not mind company, quiet as she could be. She enjoyed being around others. But sometimes...
I spent most of yesterday with my family. They can be... tiring. Demanding.
I know how you feel, the prince said dryly.
A smile tugged at her lips.
I suppose you do.
You love them, though.
And you do not?
A bold, brash question.
Sartak shrugged. Kadara is my family. The Rukin, they are my family. My bloodline, though? It's hard to love one another when we will one day contend with each other. Love cannot exist without trust.
He smiled at his Rook.
I trust Kadara with my life. I would die for her, and she for me. Can I say the same of my siblings? My own parents?
It's a shame, Nezrin admitted.
At least I have her, he said of the Rook, and my riders. Pity my siblings who have none of those blessings.
He was a good man, the prince. He was a good man.
She strode for the open archways overlooking the deadly drop to the city far, far below.
I am going to leave soon. For the mountains of the Rukin, Sartak said softly. To seek the answers you and I discussed the other night in the city.
Nezrin peered over her shoulder at him, trying to gather the right words.
The nerve.
His face remained neutral, even as he added,
I'm sure your family will have my head for offering, but would you like to accompany me?
Yes, she wanted to breathe, but she made herself ask,
For how long?
For time was not on her side, their side, and to hunt for answers while so many threats gathered close.
A few weeks, no more than three. I like to keep the riders in line, and if I go absent for too long, they pull at the leash. So the journey will serve two purposes, I suppose.
I would need to discuss with Lord Westfall.
She'd promised him as much last night. That they'd consider this precise path, weighing the pitfalls and benefits. They were still a team in that regard. Still served under the same banner. Sartak nodded solemnly, as if he could read everything on her face.
Of course. Though I leave soon.
She then heard it. The grunts of servants coming up the airy stairs, bringing supplies.
You leave now,
Nezrin clarified, as she noted the spear leaning against the far wall near the supply racks.
Isulde.
The russet horsehair tied beneath the blade drifted in the wind weaving through the airy. The dark wood shaft polished and smooth. Sartak's onyx eyes seemed to darken further as he strode to his Isulde, weighing the spirit banner in his hands before resting it beside him, the wood thunking on the stone floor. It was the first she'd seen him stumble for words.
You weren't going to say goodbye?
She had no right to make such demands, expect such things, tentative allies or no. But Sartak leaned his Isulde against the wall again and began braiding back his black hair.
After last night's party, I had thought you would be preoccupied.
With Kaol. Her brows rose.
All day?
The prince gave her a roguish smile, finishing off his long braid and picking up his spear once more.
I certainly would take all day.
By some god's mercy, Nezrin was saved from replying by the servants who appeared, panting and red-faced with the packs between them. Weapons glinted from some of them, along with food and blankets.
How far is it?
A few hours before nightfall, then all day tomorrow, then another half-day of travel to reach the first of the Ares in the Tavern Mountains,
Sartak said, as he handed his Isulde to a passing servant, and Kadara patiently allowed them to load her with various packs.
You don't fly at night?
I tire. Kadara doesn't. Foolish riders have made that mistake, and tumbled through the clouds in their dreams.
She bit her lip.
How long until you go?
An hour.
An hour to think. She had not told Kaol that she'd seen his toes move last night. She'd seen them curl and flex in his sleep. She had cried, silent tears of joy sliding onto the pillow. She hadn't told him. And when he'd awoken,
Let's have an adventure, Nezrin Falik,
he'd promised her in Rifthold. She had cried then, too. But perhaps neither of them had seen. The path ahead, the forks in it. She could see down one path clearly. Honor and loyalty still unbroken, even if it stifled him, stifled her, and She did not want to be a consolation prize, be pitied, or a distraction. But this other path, the fork that had appeared, branching away across grasslands and jungles and rivers and mountains, this path toward answers that might help them, might mean nothing, might change the course of this war, all carried on Uruk's golden wings. She would have an adventure, for herself, this one time. She would see her homeland and smell it and breathe it in, see it from high above, see it racing as fast as the wind. She owed herself that much, and owed it to Kaol as well. Perhaps she and this dark-eyed prince might find some scrap of salvation against Morath, and perhaps she might bring an army back with her. Sartak was still watching, his face carefully neutral as the last of the servants bowed and vanished. His Sulde had been strapped just below the saddle, within easy reach should the prince need it, its reddish horsehairs trailing in the wind, trailing southward, toward that distant, wild land of the Tavan Mountains, beckoning, as all spirit banners did, toward an unknown horizon, beckoning to claim whatever waited there. Nezrin said quietly, "Yes." The prince blinked. "I will go with you," she clarified. A small smile tugged on his mouth. "Good." Sartak jerked his chin to the archway through which the servants had vanished down the minaret. "Pack lightly, though. Kadara is already near her limit." Nezrin shook her head, noting the bow and quiver stocked with arrows already atop Kadara. "I have nothing to bring with me." Sartak watched her for a long moment.
"Surely you would wish to say goodbye."
"I have nothing," she repeated. His eyes flickered at that, but she added, I'll leave a note." The prince solemnly nodded.
"I can outfit you with clothes when we arrive. There is paper and ink in the cabinet by the far wall. Leave the letter in the box by the stairs, and one of the messengers will come to check at nightfall."
Her hands shook slightly as she obeyed. Not with fear, but freedom. She wrote two notes. The first one, to her aunt and uncle, was full of love and warning and well wishes. Her second note, it was quick and to the point. "I have gone with Sartak to see the Rukin. I shall be gone 3 weeks. I hold you to no promises, and I will hold to none of my own." Nezrin shut both notes in the box, undoubtedly checked often for any messages from the skies, and changed into the leathers she'd left from the last time she'd flown. She found Sartak atop Kadara, waiting for her. The prince extended a calloused hand to help her up into the saddle. She didn't hesitate as she took his hand, his strong fingers wrapping around hers, and let him pull her into the saddle before him. He strapped and buckled them in, checking all of it thrice, but he reined in Kadara when she would have soared out of the minaret. Sartak whispered in Nezrin's ear,
"I was praying to the eternal sky and all 36 gods that you'd say yes."
She smiled, even if he couldn't see it.
"So was I,"
Nezrin breathed, and they leaped into the skies. Chapter 25. Irene and Kaol hurried to the Torre Library immediately after lunch. Kaol mounted his horse with relative ease, Shen giving him a hearty pat on the back in approval. Some small part of Irene had wanted to beam when she noticed that Kaol met the man's eyes to offer a tight smile of thanks. And when they passed through those white walls, as the mass of the Torre rose above them, and the scent of lemon and lavender filled Irene's nose, some part of her eased in its presence. Just how it had done from the first moment she'd spied the tower rising above the city, while her ship at last neared the shore. As if it were a pale arm thrust toward the sky in greeting. As if to proclaim to her, "Welcome, daughter, we have been waiting for you." The Torre's library was located in the lower levels. Most of its halls ramped, thanks to the rolling carts the librarians used to transport the books around and collect any tomes that careless acolytes had forgotten to return. There were a few stairs where Irene had been forced to grit her teeth and haul him up. He'd stared at her when she'd done it, and when she asked why, he'd said it was the first time she'd touched his chair, moved it. She supposed it was, but she'd warned him not to get used to it, and let him propel himself through the brightly lit corridors of the Torre. A few of the girls from her defense class spotted them, and paused to fawn over the Lord, who indulged them with a crooked smile that set them giggling as they walked away. Irene herself smiled at them as they departed, shaking her head. Or perhaps the good mood was from the fact that his entire foot from the ankle down was regaining feeling and movement. She'd forced him to endure another set of exercises before coming here, sprawling him on the carpet, while she aided him in moving his foot around and around, in stretching it, rotating it, all designed to get the blood flowing, to hopefully awaken more of his legs. The progress was enough to keep Irene smiling until they reached Nusha's desk, where the librarian was currently shoving a few tomes into her heavy satchel, packing up for the day. Irene glanced at the bell that had been rung only a few nights ago, but refused to blanch. Kaol had brought a sword and dagger, and she'd been mesmerized while he buckled them on with such efficiency. He had barely needed to look, his fingers guided by sheer muscle memory. She could picture it. Every morning and night that he'd put on and removed that sword belt. Irene leaned over the desk and said to Nusha, who was sizing up Kaol while he also assessed her, "I would like to see where you found those texts from Eelway. And the scrolls." Nusha's white brows crossed. "Will it bring trouble?" Her gaze slid to the sword Kaol had positioned across his lap, to keep it from clacking against his chair.
"Not if I can help it," Irene said quietly.
Behind them, curled on an armchair in the large sitting area before the crackling hearth, a snow-white bast cat half slumbered, her long tail swishing like a pendulum as it draped over the edge of the cushion, no doubt listening to every word, likely to report to her sisters. Nusha sighed sharply in a way that Irene had witnessed 100 times, but waved them toward the main hallway. She barked an order in Halha to a nearby librarian to mind the desk, and led the way. As they followed, the white bast cat cracked open a green eye. Irene made sure to give her a respectful bow of the head. The cat merely went back to sleep, satisfied. For long minutes, Irene watched Kaol take in the colored lanterns, the warm stone walls, and endless stacks.
"This would give the Royal Library in Rifthold a run for its money," he observed.
"Is it that large?"
"Yes, but this might be larger. Older, definitely."
His eyes danced with shadows, bits of memory that she wondered if she would glimpse the next time she worked on him. Today's encounter, it had left her reeling and raw. But the salt of her tears had been cleansing, in a way she had not known she needed. Down and down they went, taking the main ramp that looped through the levels. They passed librarians shelving books, acolytes in solitary or group study around the tables, healers poring over musty tomes in doorless rooms, and the occasional bast cat sprawled over the top of the shelves, or padding into the shadows, or simply sitting at a crossroads, as if waiting. Still, they went deeper.
"How did you know they were down here?"
Irene asked Nusha's back.
"We keep good records," was all the head librarian said.
Kaol gave Irene a look that said,
"We have cranky librarians in Rifthold, too."
Irene bit her lip to keep from grinning. Nusha could sniff out laughter and amusement like a bloodhound on a scent, and shut it down as viciously, too. At last, they reached a dark corridor that reeked of stone and dust.
"Second shelf down. Don't ruin anything," Nusha said by way of explanation and farewell, and left without a look back.
Kaol's brows lifted in bemusement,
and Irene swallowed her chuckle.
It stopped being an effort as they approached the shelf the librarian had indicated. Piles of scrolls lay tucked beneath books, whose spines glittered with the Ilwe language. Kaol let out a low whistle through his teeth.
How old is the Torre exactly?
1500 years.
He went still. This library has been here that long?
She nodded. It was all built in one go, a gift from an ancient queen to the healer who saved her child's life. A place for the healer to study and live, close to the palace, and to invite others to study as well.
So it predates the Khaganate by a great deal.
The Khagans are the latest in a long line of conquerors since then. The most benevolent since that first queen, to be sure. Even her palace itself did not survive so well as the Torre. What you stay in now. They built it atop the rubble of the queen's castle. After the conquerors, who came a generation before the Khaganate, razed it to the ground. He swore, low and creatively. Healers, Irene said, scanning the shelves, are in high demand, whether you are the current ruler or the invading one. All other posts, perhaps unnecessary. But a tower full of women who can keep you from death, even if you are hanging by a thread.
More valuable than gold.
It begs the question of why Otterland's last king.
She almost said your king, but the word clanged strangely in her head now.
Why he felt the need to destroy those of us with the gift in his own continent. Why the thing in him felt the need,
she didn't say. Kaol didn't meet her eyes, and not from shame.
He knew something.
Something else.
What? She asked. He scanned the dim stacks, then listened for anyone nearby.
He was indeed taken. Invaded. It had been a shock to realize whose dark power she'd been fighting against within his wound.
A shock, and yet a rallying cry to her magic, as if some fog had been cleared away, some veil of fear, and all that had been left beneath were her blinding rage and sorrow, unfaltering as she'd leaped upon the darkness. But the king truly had been possessed then, all this time. Kaol pulled a book from the shelf and flipped through it, not really reading the pages. She was fairly certain he didn't know how to read Ilwe.
He knew what was happening to him. The man within him fought against it as best he could. He knew that their kind,
the Vog,
they found people with gifts, enticing.
Magic wielders.
Knew their kind wanted to conquer the gifted ones, for their power.
Infest them, as the king had been, as that drawing in the Song of Beginning had depicted. Irene's gut roiled.
So the man within wrested control long enough to give the order that the magic wielders were to be put down, executed, rather than used against him. Us.
Turned into hosts for those demons and made into weapons. Irene leaned against the stack behind them. A hand sliding up to her throat. Her pulse pounded beneath her fingers.
It was a choice he hated himself for, but saw as a necessary decision to make, along with a way to make sure those in control could not use magic, or find those who had it. Not without lists of them, or those willing to sell them out for coin, to the men he ordered to hunt them down.
Magic's vanishing had not been natural at all. He found a way to banish?
A sharp nod. It is a long story, but he halted it. Dammed it up. To keep those conquerors from having the hosts they wanted. And then hunted the rest of them down to make sure their numbers were fewer still.
The King of Otterland had stopped magic, killed its bearers, had sent his forces to execute her mother and countless others, not just from blind hatred and ignorance, but some twisted way of trying to save their kind. Her heart thundered through her body. But healers, we have no power to use in battle,
Nothing beyond what you see from me.
Kaol was utterly still as he stared at her. I think you might have something they want very badly.
The hair along her arms rose.
Or want to keep you from knowing too much about.
She swallowed, feeling the blood leave her face. Like your wound.
A nod. She blew out a shaky breath, going to the stack before her. The scrolls.
His fingers grazed her own.
I will not let any harm come to you.
Irene felt him waiting for her to tell him otherwise, but she believed him. And what I showed you earlier?
She said, inclining her head to the scrolls. The word marks, he'd called them. Part of the same thing. An earlier and different sort of power. Outside of magic.
And he had a friend who could read them. Wield them. We'd better be quick, she said, still careful of any potential listeners. I'm sure the volume I need for your chronic toe fungus is down here somewhere, and I'm growing hungry. Kaol gave her an incredulous look.
She offered him an apologetic wince in return.
But laughter danced in his eyes as he began pulling books into his lap. Nezrin's face and ears were numb with cold by the time Kadara alighted on a rocky outcropping high atop a small mountain range of gray stone. Her limbs were hardly better, despite the leathers, and were sore enough that she winced as Sartak helped her down. The prince grimaced.
I forgot that you aren't used to riding for so long.
It wasn't the stiffness that really brutalized her, but her bladder. Clenching her legs together, Nezrin surveyed the campsite the Rook had deemed suitable for her master. It was protected on three sides by boulders and pillars of gray rock, with a broad overhang against the elements, but no possibility of concealment. And asking a prince where to cedar her needs. Sartak merely pointed to a cluster of boulders.
There's privacy that way, if you need it.
Face heating, Nezrin nodded, not quite able to meet him in the eye as she hurried to where he'd indicated, slipping between two boulders to find another little outcropping that opened onto a sheer drop to the unforgiving rocks and streams far, far below. She picked a small boulder that faced away from the wind and didn't waste any time unbuckling her pants. When she emerged again, still wincing, Sartak had removed most of the packs from Kadara, but had left her saddle. Nezrin approached the mighty bird, who eyed her closely, lifting a hand toward the first buckle.
Don't.
Sartak said calmly, from where he'd set the last of the packs under the overhang, his Sulde tucked against the wall behind them.
We leave the saddles on while we travel.
Nezrin lowered her hand, examining the mighty bird. Why? Sartak removed two bedrolls and laid them out against the rocky wall, claiming one for himself.
If we're ambushed, if there is some danger, we need to be able to get into the skies.
Nezrin scanned the surrounding mountain range, the sky stained pink and orange as the sun set. The Asimil Mountains, a small, lonely range, if her memory of the land served her correctly. Still far, far north from the Tavan Mountains of the Rukin. They hadn't passed a village or sign of civilization in over an hour. And up amongst these desolate peaks, landslides, flash floods. She supposed there were dangers aplenty. Supposed that the only ones who could reach them up here were other rooks, or wyverns. Sartak pulled out tins of cured meats and fruit, along with two small loaves of bread.
Have you seen them? The mounts of Morath.
His question was nearly ripped away by the howl of the wind beyond the wall of rocks. How he'd known where her mind had drifted, she couldn't guess. Kadara settled herself near one of the three faces, folding in her wings tightly. They'd stopped once earlier, to let Kadara feed and for them to see to their needs, so the Rook wouldn't have to seek out dinner in these barren mountains. Belly still full, Kadara now seemed content to doze.
Yes, Nezrin admitted,
tugging free the leather strap around the base of her short braid and finger-combing her hair. Tangles snared on her still-freezing fingers as she coaxed them away, grateful for the task that kept her from shuddering at the memory of the witches and their mounts. Kadara is probably two-thirds to half the size of a wyvern. Maybe. Is she large or small for a rook?
I thought you'd heard all the stories about me.
Nezrin snorted, shaking out her hair a final time as she approached the bedroll and food he'd laid out for her. Do you know they call you the Winged Prince? A ghost of a smile.
Yes.
Do you like the title? She settled on the roll, crossing her legs beneath her. Sartak passed her the tin of fruits, beckoning her to eat. She didn't bother to wait for him before she dug in, the grapes cool thanks to the hours in the crisp air.
Do I like the title?
He mused, tearing off a piece of bread and passing it to her. She took it with a nod of thanks.
It's strange, I suppose, to become a story while you are still alive.
A sidelong glance at her while he ripped into his bread.
You yourself are surrounded by some living tales. How do they feel about it?
Aelin certainly enjoys it. She'd never met another person with so many names and titles, and who enjoyed bandying them about so much. The others? I don't suppose I know them well enough to guess. Though Adian Ashriver, he takes after Aelin. She popped another grape into her mouth, her hair swaying as she leaned forward to pluck a few more into her palm. They're cousins, but act more like siblings. A considering look.
The Wolf of the North.
You've heard of him. Sartak passed the tin of cured meats, letting her pick through which slices she wanted.
I told you, Captain Falik. My spies do their jobs well.
A careful line. Nudging him toward a potential alliance was a careful line to walk.
Look too eager, praise her companions too much, and she'd be transparent.
But to do nothing, it went against her very nature. Even as a city guard, her day off had usually sent her looking for something to do. Whether it was a walk through Rifthold or helping her father and sister prepare the next day's goods. Windseeker, her mother had once called her. Unable to keep still, always wandering where the wind calls you. Where shall it beckon you to journey one day, my rose? How far the wind had now called her. Nezrin said, Then I hope your spies have told you that Adian's Bane is a skilled legion. A vague nod. And she knew Sartak saw right through all her plans. But he finished off part of the bread and asked,
And what are the tales they tell about you, Nezrin Falik?
She chewed on the salted pork. No one has any stories about me. It didn't bother her. Fame, notoriety. She valued other things more, she supposed.
Not even the story about the arrow that saved a shapeshifter's life? The impossible shot fired from a rooftop?
She snapped her head toward him. Sartak only swigged from his water with a look that said,
I told you my spies were good.
I thought Argan was the one who dealt in covert information, Nezrin said carefully. He passed the water skin.
Argan's the one who boasts about it. I'd hardly call it covert.
Nezrin drank a few mouthfuls of water and lifted a brow. But this is... Sartak chuckled.
I suppose you're right.
The shadows grew deeper, longer, the wind picking up. She studied the rock around them, the packs. You won't risk a fire.
A shake of his head, his dark braid swaying. It'd be a beacon.
He frowned at her leathers, the packs lumped around them.
I have heavy blankets, somewhere in there.
They fell into silence, eating while the sun vanished and stars began to blink awake among the last vibrant ribbon of blue. The moon herself appeared, bathing the campsite with enough light to see by as they finished up, the prince sealing the tins and tucking them back into the packs. Across the space, Kadara began to snore, a deep wheeze that rumbled through the rock.
Sartak chuckled.
Apologies if that keeps you awake.
Nezrin just shook her head, sharing a campsite with a rook in the mountains high above the grassy plains below, the winged prince beside her. No, her family would not believe it. They watched the stars quietly, neither making a move to sleep. One by one, the rest of the stars emerged, brighter and clearer than she'd seen since those weeks on the ship here. Different stars, she realized with a jolt, than those up north. Different. And yet these stars had burned for countless centuries above her ancestors, above her father himself. Had it been strange for him to leave them behind? Had he missed them? He'd never spoken of it. What it was like to move to a land with foreign stars, if he'd felt adrift at night.
Neith's arrow, Sartak said after uncounted minutes, leaning back against the rock.
Nezrin dragged her gaze from the stars to find his face limned in moonlight, silver dancing along the pure onyx of his braid. He rested his forearms on his knees.
That's what my spies called you. What I called you until you arrived.
Neith's arrow. The goddess of archery. And the hunt. Originally hailing from an ancient sand-swept kingdom to the west. Now enfolded into the Khaganate's vast pantheon. A corner of his mouth tugged upward.
So don't be surprised if there's now a story or two about you. Already finding its way across the world.
Nezrin observed him for a long moment, the howling mountain wind blending with Kadara snoring. She'd always excelled at archery, took pride in her unmatched aim. But she had not learned because she coveted renown. She'd done it because she enjoyed it, because it gave her a direction to aim that wind-seeking inclination. And yet, Sartak cleared away the last of the food and did a quick check that the campsite was secure before heading off between the boulders himself. With only those foreign stars to witness, Nezrin smiled. Chapter 26 Kaol dined in the Tore kitchens, where a rail-thin woman called only cook had stuffed him with pan-fried fish, crusty bread, roasted tomatoes with mild cheese and tarragon, and then managed to convince him to eat a light, flaky pastry dripping with honey and crusted in pistachios. Irene had sat beside him, hiding her smiles as cook kept piling more and more food onto his plate, until he literally begged her to stop. He was full enough that the idea of moving seemed a monumental task, and even Irene had pleaded with cook to have mercy upon them. The woman had relented, though she'd turned that focus upon the workers in her kitchen, presiding over the serving of the evening meal to the hall a level above, with a general's command that Kaol found himself studying. He and Irene sat in companionable silence, watching the chaos unfold around them, until the sun had long since set through the wide windows beyond the kitchen. He'd uttered half a mention of getting his horse saddled when Irene and cook told him he was spending the night, and to not bother arguing. So he did. He sent a note back to the palace through a healer on her way there to oversee a patient in the servants' quarters, telling Nezrin where he was and not to wait up. And when he and Irene had finally managed to get their overstuffed stomachs to settle, he followed her to a room in the complex. The Tore was mostly stairs, she said with no pity whatsoever, and there were no guest rooms anyway. But the adjacent physician's complex, she'd gestured to the building they'd passed through, all angles and squares where the Tore was round, always had a few rooms on the ground level available for the night, mostly for the loved ones of sick patients. She opened the door to a room that overlooked a garden courtyard, the space small but clean. Its pale walls inviting and warm from the day. A narrow bed lay against one wall, a chair and small table before the window, just enough space for him to maneuver. "Let me see again," Irene said, pointing to his feet. Kaol lifted his leg with his hands, stretching it out, then rolled his ankles, grunting against the considerable weight of his legs. She removed his boots and socks as she knelt before him.
Good. We'll need to keep that up.
He glanced to the satchel full of books and scrolls she'd pillaged from the library, discarded by the doorway. He didn't know what the hell any of it said, but they'd taken as many as they could. If whoever or whatever had been in that library had stolen some, and perhaps not gotten the chance to return for more, he wouldn't risk them eventually returning to claim the rest. Irene had thought the scroll she'd hidden in his rooms to be 800 years old. But that deep in the library, considering the age of the Tore? He didn't tell her he thought it might be much, much older. Full of information that might not have even survived in their own lands.
I can find you some clothes, Irene said, scanning the small room.
I'll be fine with what I have,
Kaol added without looking at her.
I sleep without them.
Ah.
Silence fell, as she no doubt remembered how she'd found him that morning. That morning? Had it truly been only hours ago? She had to be exhausted. Irene gestured to the candle burning on the table.
Do you need more light?
I'm fine.
I can get you some water.
I'm fine,
he said, the corners of his mouth twitching upward. She pointed to the porcelain pot in the corner.
Then at least let me bring you the—
I can manage that, too. It's all about aim.
Color stained her cheeks.
Right.
She chewed on her bottom lip.
Well, good night, then.
He could have sworn she was lingering. And he would have let her, except—
It's late,
he told her.
You should go to your room while people are still about.
Because while Nezrin had found no trace of the Volg in Antica, while it had been days since that attack in the Tore Library, he would take no risks.
Yes,
Irene said, bracing a hand on the threshold. She reached for the handle to pull the door shut behind her.
Irene.
She paused, angling her head. Kaol held her stare, a small smile curling his mouth.
Thank you,
he swallowed.
For all of it.
She only nodded and backed out, shutting the door behind her. But as she did so, he caught a glimmer of the light that danced in her eyes. The following morning, a stern-faced woman named Arisha appeared at his door to inform him Irene had a meeting with Hafiza and would meet him at the palace by lunch. So Irene had asked Arisha to escort him back to the palace, a task Kaol could only wonder why she'd bestowed on the old woman, who tapped her foot as he gathered his weapons, the heavy bag of books, and clicked her tongue at every minor delay. But the ride through the steep streets with Arisha wasn't awful. The woman was a surprisingly skilled rider who brooked no nonsense from her mount. Yet she offered no pleasantries, and little more than a grunted farewell before she left him in the palace courtyard. The guards were just changing their shift, the morning rotation lingering to chat amongst one another. He recognized enough of them by now to earn a few nods of greeting, and to manage to return them as his chair was brought over by one of the stable hands. He'd no sooner removed his feet from the stirrups and prepared himself for the still daunting process of dismounting, when light footsteps jogged over to him. He looked over to find Shen approaching, a hand on his forearm. Kaol blinked, and by the time Shen stopped before him, the guard had tugged the glove back on his hand. Or what Kaol had assumed was his hand. Because what he glimpsed beneath the glove and the sleeve of Shen's uniform, going right up to the elbow, it was a masterwork, the metal forearm in hand. And only now that he looked long enough to actually observe anything, he could indeed see the raised lines by Shen's bicep of where the metal arm was strapped to him. Shen noticed his stare. Noticed it right as Kaol hesitated at the arm and shoulder Shen offered to aid him in dismounting. The guard said in Kaol's own tongue,
I hoped you'd just fine before you knew, Lord Westfall.
Something like